It's 8:30, so I'd like to start, even though people are going to keep rolling in. All they'll miss is my introduction.
She's probably the best part.
I'm Chris Sharon, and together with Sonia in the yellow sweatshirt over there, I'm working to coordinate the teaching staff. In the summer, one of the wonderful aspects of that is helping to surface good topics for community forums and conversations on issues going on in our church and society. And we wanted to set aside some moment during the week while Bradley's here to talk about our effort in the Lutheran Church and many churches, not just the Lutheran Church, to become more fully welcoming, especially in relationship to our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. And so this forum tonight is intended for us to ask that question out of our experience. So let me say a couple of things about what it's not, and then introduce a little bit of how I come to this and to a relationship with Bradley before I invite him to share a little bit about his story and especially his recent experience being de-rostered in the ELCA. What it's not is, it's not, tonight's not about what the Bible says or doesn't say about homosexuality. And it's not about the issue of homosexuality per se, or about the draft social statement that the ELCA has put out. There's a lot of topics related to what we're trying to get at tonight that could be brought up, but we want to invite everyone to come to this conversation out of your life story, out of what's moved and changed you, so that we're talking about how we experience the church's struggle with this. How do we embody the welcome we understand Christ to extend and to call us to extend? So that's the character of the conversation we want to have, and partly we want to frame it that way because that's the story Bradley's going to tell. He's been through an amazing experience, and will speak out of that, inviting us to consider his experience and to share with him where we're coming from. So when I went to seminary, the ELCA had just formed in the late 80s, and I started seminary in 1991 in Berkeley. And during that time, three seminarians at my seminary in Berkeley had finished, were all approved for call to ordained ministry, and came out together and said, we're gay. And there was a collective gasp among the College of Bishops and in the headquarters in Chicago. And pretty soon they put together a one-page document called Sexual Expectations for Candidates for Ministry, which was the first draft of Vision and Expectations, which talked about all the expectations for candidates for ministry, including a section on what to do and not to do when with the relationship to sex. And in the midst of that, I was in classes with a number of just brilliant, beautiful gay and lesbian seminarians trying to figure out what to do about the fact that all of a sudden there was a very high and intense investigation culture among candidacy committees. And so I got, first of all, I think angry, and then active, trying to figure out how can I be an advocate for them, since I, as a straight white male, could go through the candidacy process and really have a hard time getting in trouble. That was the moment when I really was pushed over the edge from observing what was happening in the church to becoming active and writing and speaking about this issue and these circumstances that we've been struggling with. That was when I was doing my master's degree in Berkeley, and I went to Atlanta to do a PhD in social ethics, and Bradley was already there in the sort of pastoral care and liturgy area. What did they call it?
Personal community and religious practice.
so ago we met as fellow doctoral students, and I learned some of his story. And we tried to find a church and ended up at St. John's in Atlanta. And Bradley was discerning what direction to go in his life and ended up deciding that he wanted to return to full-time parish ministry, and our congregation called him. And so we had the opportunity to know each other as friends in the doctoral program and then as pastor and parishioner at St. John's. And it's just been one more example of many, many relationships in my life that have compelled me not to sit on the sidelines, but to try and speak about a truth that I'm trying to understand more deeply. And I think that it's partly been, for me, a journey of understanding more deeply the witness of the gospel and scripture, and finding ways out of our Lutheran theological tradition to speak words of affirmation and to imagine what a church would look like structurally if we weren't drawing a line and saying, you're welcome up to this point. So that's a little of my story and a little of how I got connected to Bradley. And it's just a delight to have you here this week, leading us in Bible study, and to have this time tonight to talk together about how welcoming we are.
Thank you. Actually, it's really great to be here. And what I thought I would do is just give kind of an overview of the story, and then give you a chance to ask what the things that you're interested in or would like to hear about, or a chance to share sort of your experiences about all of this. It's interesting that you mentioned going to Berkeley. I was on my seminary internship when Jeff and Ruth and Phyllis came out, so read about this, you know, big excitement in the Lutheran. But at the time, I was married to a woman. I wasn't out to myself. So I kind of noticed that with interest, but pushed it back behind everything, which I had done, you know, in my life up until then. And I graduated from seminary and was called to Calvary Lutheran Church in Columbus, Ohio, and was ordained in November of 1989, at the beginning of the month. In the middle of November 1989, the ELCA Church Council adopted the current policy that we have that precludes practicing homosexuals from the ordained ministry. So it's sort of interesting that I was ordained the same month that the policy was officially instituted. So I suppose it was only a matter of time before those two things sort of came into some kind of conflict. But I was able to be ordained fairly easily because I was married. So I wasn't even questioned when I went through Kansas. No one asked about anything. So I was ordained and took my first call. And during that time, I came to the place of really accepting that I was gay. And that brought an end, very sadly, to our marriage. My wife and I are still close to each other. We call each other every year on our anniversary. So I've been able to create a really tender relationship out of that. But it was a very painful experience at the time. And about a year and a half after that, about a year or so, I decided I needed to leave parish ministry. I didn't see a way that you could be gay and be a pastor in the church. I told a few people in the congregation who said, that's no problem to us. You should tell everybody. So over time in that congregation, I began to come out to them. And then it sort of reached a critical point. And then in a period of about 5 weeks, it was Advent of 1991, I visited every member of the congregation to tell them that I was gay. I didn't want to do that in a sermon. I didn't want to, you know, send out a letter, something about, you know. Because for me, the relationships were really crucial. I loved the people there. And I wanted them to to have the chance to hear that story coming from me and have them have a chance to talk to me about that. Long and short of that is that I ended up staying there for another 2.5 years. Turned out to be fine for the congregation. There were a few people who left, but by and large, that congregation then developed a great sense of energy around inclusivity and grew quite a bit. But I was still struggling with how do you be gay and ordained, and really didn't see that I had any possibilities after this call. And it was my first call, so it was sort of time to go, to move on. So that's when I decided to go to Emory to do doctoral work, thinking work in the academy would be something that would be next to the church, which would allow me the freedom to be close, but not under the microscope of being in. So I did that for 5 years and worked on the religious life staff at Emory. When St. John's Lutheran Church called and asked if I'd be interested in interviewing for the call. And I had worshiped there a little bit while I was at Emory, so knew the congregation, actually had joined that congregation, although I was not very regular in my church attendance at the time. So stayed sort of really on the margins of that congregation, but really thought that it was a place that had its heart in the right place. So when they asked, I was really interested, but I thought, this is just not going to work. And so I said to the call committee, you know that I'm gay, right? And they're like, yeah, we know. That's not a problem for us. We want to talk to you. So I went and met with the call committee, had one of those kind of conversations where you just feel like this was meant to be. It was sort of a spirit conversation. I think everybody in the room felt it. But I thought, this just can't go, because it's going to come to the council. You know, it's going to be divisive. Well, they recommended me to the council. The council approved, said, let's send it to the congregation. It went to the congregation, and there were 6 no votes, and I think 90 positive votes, including these 2. I'm assuming they were in the affirmative. If they voted no, it was for other reasons.
We'll talk later.
Yeah, right. Which was a pretty overwhelming kind of vote. In a lot of call processes, there's often more than that who vote against a candidate for all kinds of reasons. 4 people left the congregation. 2 people had a great conversion experience on the whole issue and were great supporters of me. One of them died just in the last year, so just one is left. But the problem came once the call got to that place. Well, before that, I had to fill out mobility papers. It's all the papers that say, tell your faith story, you know, you write and answer questions. But there's a little box on the form that says, I agree to be in compliance with all ELCA guidelines and expectations. It's one innocuous sentence with one little box, which placed me in this great moral dilemma, because the policy is wrong, and I was single at the time, so I could have checked the box and had access to the system, but I felt like I just couldn't do that because too many of my close friends had been denied candidacy or couldn't get calls or left congregations. There was just too much pain, and I had to find a way to be in solidarity with them. So I wrote this 2-page appendix to my call papers why I couldn't in good conscience check the box. And I gave theological, pastoral, ecclesiological, personal reasons all why I couldn't, and thought, really, this is the end of my ordained ministry. Because what was also happening is my leave from call, my academic leave from call, was coming to an end. And so I thought I would then be dropped from the roster. Well, amazingly, the bishop put my name through. One of the things I said to him in a conversation was I told him I was single and that if that changed, I would come and tell him. So I started at St. John's, amazing place to serve, great congregation, and we did that for 4 wonderful years. And then I went to a conference in Minneapolis, Lutherans Concerned Conference, and saw this guy across the room. I mean, this is like everybody's mother's dream. I met my partner in church. as it had turned out, he is an ELCA pastor who came out in his congregation in Zumbrota, Minnesota, 1,200 member congregation, who then wanted him to stay. Darren Eastler is his name. And we had talked on the phone when he was coming out to his congregation, but I didn't really know that. Sorry if I tell a little bit of a love story. This is my favorite part of the story. but I didn't know that was the same person when I saw him. And so we eventually talked, and then the rest is history, so to speak. But he was in Minneapolis. I was in Atlanta. So we dated 1,000 miles apart for a year. And then when it came time to really make our relationship one of permanence, Darren moved to Atlanta. And we knew that the moment was coming when those two things, the policy, my ordination, would sort of come to a head. His ordination and the policy. He decided that he really didn't have the stomach for the fight. So he decided to transfer to the United Church of Christ, one of our full communion partners. So began that process. I then went to my bishop to tell him to follow through on what I had said that I was going to do. To tell him that I had met the love of my life. And he asked me to resign. To resign from St. John's, to resign from the clergy roster of the church. I was also the dean of our conference. And to resign as the dean. And I said, well, I'll give you one of the three. Because I didn't really want to be dean anyway. So when he asked me to resign, I said no. And I my no was based in all those same reasons that I had written in that appendix. That I couldn't in good conscience resign from a call that felt alive and real and vibrant for the sake of a policy that I believe is theologically and ethically wrong. Part of what pastors promise also is to stand in solidarity with the oppressed and to speak for justice. And we're the Church of the Reformation. So to work and be committed to reform. So I said no, I couldn't. That night told the church council that I was in a relationship with Darren, and their first reaction was, well, we have to have a party. which they planned and pulled off, which was a wonderful sort of wedding reception for us. They produced a DVD of all the things that Darren should know about me. Since they had known me longer than him. What happened then was that after 5 months, the bishop formally filed charges with the secretary of the ELCA, which initiated then a formal disciplinary process. Which led then to an ecclesiastical trial that was held in January of 2007, which was functioned very much, if you went into any civil trial, it would look like my church trial. There was a jury of 12, there was a judge, each side had attorneys, and everything was handled by briefs through attorneys. We called witnesses, from our side, we tried to make the case that in 2005, when the churchwide assembly met and adopted a resolution calling for the church to journey together faithfully in the midst of disagreement, that that was the will of the ELCA. The policy that we have has never been adopted by a churchwide assembly. It's been adopted by the church council of the ELCA, but never by the whole body. So we wanted to argue that the will of the body was to find a way through, that we know we're in disagreement, but we want to, as a church, find a way to keep going.
Rob, when you say we, are you referring to you and your congregation, or exactly who is that we?
The we became a whole community of people.
Okay.
The we became, I had co-counsel, one who was an attorney, but also a Presbyterian pastor, and a former bishop, Bob Rimbaud from Detroit. There was also a legal team that was meeting regularly to strategize, to plan for the trial. There was the media. Ironically, the bishop put this on the website of the synod the day after the charges were filed. So immediately, all of the Atlanta media and eventually media across the country was aware of the story. So we had teams who were managing the media interest. And then the congregation was trying to manage, how do we move through something like this in a faithful kind of way? And what we decided to do was to worship. That while the trial was going on, there was worship scheduled every night at St. John's, which were beautiful services that they pulled together. People came from all over the country to be with us. So all of that, when I say we, is this whole community that kind of participated in all of this. We had witnesses that included Herb Chilstrom, who was the first bishop of the ELCA, who was the bishop when the policy was instituted, who thought it was the right thing at the time, but now believes that if it served a purpose, that purpose is now done, and the policy needs to be revoked. We had New Testament scholars, theologians, and then witnesses from the congregation to come and talk about the ministry. We kept saying, can we have the jury come to church? We want this body to experience us as a church. But that was not, it's a very programmed kind of process.
What was the nature of the jury, and who was the judge?
There's a group of people who are elected by the ELCA to serve as judges, should there be a disciplinary process. The jury is also elected by the national church. Six of the jury are from the national church. There's a pool. And each synod has a pool of potential jurors.
Ordained, lay?
A mix. Half ordained, half lay, half from the national church, half from the synod. And they're chosen in a kind of random sort of way, in a way that's designed to try not to stack the deck on either side. The ELCA has a law firm that represents it in everything. They were the law firm that represented the ELCA in the trial. The trial, by the way, cost $250,000. What happened though?
What's the legal issue that you're...
The issue is that I'm no longer practicing, or I am now a practicing homosexual. Actually, I feel like I'm an accomplished. that I am in violation of this policy of the church, which calls really for celibacy for GLBT clergy.
But for all,
in fact, anyone who's not married,
right,
which includes right. all GLBT people, because they're not allowed to marry, so it's just a blanket.
Right. So you were in violation of a policy that you had never, I mean, you didn't check that box ever, right?
Right, I didn't agree to abide by the policy, but that didn't really change that the policy was in effect. And the piece, that there was also a couple theological pieces that were very important to me, that go to the core of Lutheranism, which is about how we make decisions about morality, when we ground our theology in justification by grace through faith, that's sort of the ground, and that we've always been a church that can have a variety of opinions on moral and social issues and still be one church. This is the only line in our documents where a contested social issue is made into a policy. I mean, you read the document. Everything else is all stuff the whole church would generally agree about. But it's one line that we're divided down the middle, but we have a policy about it. The other piece, one second, was that Lutherans have always given great authority to the community of laity that gather around word and sacrament to call the pastor that is best for the mission of that particular place. We were never arguing that I should be called to any ELCA church. I probably wouldn't want to go to all of them, you know. But can this congregation, who does not see this as an issue in any way, call the pastor that it wants? And all of the guidelines are for the sake of the proclamation of the gospel and the administration of the sacraments. So everything that in our rules should be things that can get in the way of the proclamation of the gospel or the administration of the sacraments. And we do, as a church, want to have guidelines and vision for clergy, because the gospel is the most important thing. But for St. John's and for many congregations in the ELCA, sexual orientation is not a barrier to the proclamation of the gospel. So we felt like there were some really serious Lutheran theological issues at stake that should be discussed, brought to light.
And in fact, blocking people like you or many other people who have the gifts to proclaim an amazing word of the gospel, the guideline is almost getting in the way of the gospel being proclaimed.
Exactly.
The opposite thing.
Let me quickly sail through the story. We have a quick question.
Well, I just had a question about federal laws. I thought that there are federal laws that prohibit all employers to discriminate against its employees based on sexual orientation.
Well, it's a not in church state. It would be a church state issue, and the state, the federal government, are very hesitant to get involved in these kind of issues in churches.
But there is no federal law that says you can't discriminate against sexual orientation.
That's right,
that's
too.
What's being argued.
And Georgia certainly does not have law to protect on the basis of sexual orientation. We have a pretty awful constitutional amendment, in fact. What happened was, and I know I'm probably talking too long here, it's hard to... But the Disciplinary Hearing Committee was finally sympathetic to the case, we really felt like. And their decision was to remove me from the clergy roster of the church. But they set the date for my removal as 1 week after the churchwide assembly that was coming up in August. So this was February. They set the date of my removal, said that the policy was bad and likely unconstitutional, which was another one of our arguments, is that the Constitution gives bishops discretion in matters of discipline. We argued that the policy eliminated all discretion. So we were trying to, they agreed with that argument, and they agreed that the policy doesn't serve the church, and they asked synods to make memorials to the churchwide assembly to change the policy. What that did was set into motion a legislative season in the ELCA that produced 22 memorials to the churchwide assembly to change the policy. There has never been any issue that has engendered that many memorials for change. That's a third of the synods of the church. It was not scheduled to be talked about in 2007. It was to be a moratorium year, you know, because 2009 is the human sexuality document year. So 2007 was supposed to be this quiet, uneventful churchwide assembly, and then this hearing committee made this decision. The bishop appealed, and the Committee on Appeals, which is like the ELCA Supreme Court, overturned the ruling, removed me from the clergy roster immediately on July 2nd of that year, about a month, 5 weeks before the churchwide assembly, removed me from the clergy roster and reprimanded the hearing committee for giving its opinion on the issue, and argued that what a hearing committee does is to enforce policy, not to think about policy. So that then led to the 2007 churchwide assembly, where the body eventually, it did not change the policy. But what the church did was pass a resolution that called for bishops to exercise restraint in the enforcement of policy. And this is really what the Conference of Bishops wanted. Because there are bishops all over this church who don't want to enforce the policy. They know they have partnered gay clergy in their synod, and they know they're doing great jobs, and they don't want trials. They don't want to be forced to file charges. So this refrain and restraint motion passed. 20 members of St. John's went to the churchwide assembly to do a panel discussion, just talking about their experience of church. 400 people came to that panel. And there was a worship service sponsored by Lutherans Concerned, one of the nights of the assembly, where 600 people came, 12 bishops. In the past, there had only been one bishop that had ever come to a service. But Margaret Payne from New England presided at that service. So there was clearly energy movement. Something happened in 2007. The other thing that passed in 2007 was a resolution calling for the ELCA to make a decision about this in 2009 on the policy, because there was a fear that it would get delayed. So we'll see what they do with that. The coda to the story is, we went back to St. John's, we went back to regular ministry, just like a week after we got back, the church was struck by lightning. We decided not to put that in the press. And our sewer backed up into the basement, so it was like, we were back to real ministry, real congregational ministry. Our congregation has grown because of what we went through. What it really did was the congregation felt called at each step. This group of people never would have ahead of time decided they would go through a national event like that. I mean, there it's St. John's is a regular congregation, ELCA. They're not, they're committed, but we're not burning to be on the front lines of any, you know, fight like this. But in each step of the way, it felt like we just have to do what's the right thing. So consequently, when a congregation, I think, chooses to be clear about who it is, energy flows, and people came to us and still are coming to us. And we couldn't have paid for the newspaper, the TV time that we got free. And we went from being a church that people knew where we were, where they could drive by. We're on a major thoroughfare. We have a pretty building, so people knew that about us. But now people know what we're about. So it's in the end, it was, I think everybody would agree, it was a blessing for the congregation. And so we continue to go on. Our synod elected a new bishop who will not file charges against the congregation for keeping me. They were clear. They were ready to be expelled. Nobody wanted to be expelled. But they were ready to do that, and we were starting to plan our strategy for acting like an ELCA congregation, even if we weren't on the list. But fortunately, that never came to pass. So we're kind of going on like almost like nothing happened. So I'll stop going on and give you a chance to either ask questions or to share your experiences or.
I was at the assembly and went to that worship service and went to the session where his congregation spoke. And both just very moving and very powerful, I thought. But one of the things I loved about what his congregation said was that we know who we are, and who we are is not activists around the issue of human sexuality. We are a faithful body of Christ. We have many ministries. Bradley doesn't talk about sexuality all the time. We talk about everything, and we do everything, and we are a normal congregation doing God's work. And they were so clear about their commitment to doing the right thing that it was just wonderful. And they did seem like perfectly ordinary people.
Yeah. Oh, I think conversation could continue going off into why do we even have national church bodies? The question that you had about the separation of church and state. I asked a question at the churchwide assembly in 1999, I can't remember, in Denver. But a bishop had outed a member of, this was in Wisconsin, had outed a member of the synod staff. Publicly out of the ministry. And I just got up and said, you know, if I did that at owning a restaurant, I would lose the restaurant in Wisconsin. That's and after a period of they didn't want to say, oh, we're gonna go back to separation of church and state, but that's really and so my question was, the huge issue at that point was who's got the blue glow of apostolic succession and how do we do that? My whole question is, why don't congregations take back the power they used to have, which was to call pastors? There was no, and there isn't really much of a pension program or a, there, when I went to seminary, it was $125 a semester. You know, now pastors come out and they're $16,000 in debt or whatever. Why do we have this ELCA thing? Why do we pay attention? Since most people have no clue what Lutheran means, unless an individual congregation is actually preaching the gospel, is a faith-based entity. And the Lutheran side, I love, but why? I don't know. And so you could go off into that. Why do we need Higgins Road? It helps Chicago's economy. I know that's what you're going to say.
Our congregation in Chicago just voted to change its constitution to say that the bishops, no presiding bishop or local, regional, our bishop, Chicago Metro Bishop, can tell us who we can call or not call. Because we called Eric Holland, who is the pastor here. And the presiding bishop said all hell was going to break loose and we had to not do that. And we got mad, and so now we've changed our constitution. We will never again back down.
And there are congregations all across the ELCA who are calling gay and lesbian candidates. And there was a day when discipline was the response to that. I think that day is past. That I think there will increasingly be congregations who are going to do what they need to do, and that's going to happen.
I want to talk about a couple of things that may seem to go in the wrong direction. So in 1783, the state of New York passed what's called a general incorporation law for churches, and it allowed churches to get charters. And so the church becomes the legal entity, the congregation becomes the legal entity. And until that time, under the way the common law works, you can't give a bequest to a non-person. So you can't give a bequest to a congregation if the congregation isn't a person. And you can't borrow money if you're not a person. So if you wanted to build a sanctuary and you weren't then the congregation wasn't a person, then everybody would be a partnership, which meant that everybody in the congregation was liable for the whole mortgage individually. And during the colonial period, the colony of New York had religious tolerance. It turned out that only Anglican and Dutch Reformed congregations could get charters. So the state of New York said, you know, we got to make this open to everybody. So here, have a charter. Which meant that there was a process by which being a church in society was established. Right? So I don't think the policy of the church is right. But there are a set of issues about what are churches in society? How does society support that? Both a self-constituting congregation and church, embedded in a larger society, figure out what the rules are. You know, and sometimes we get bad rules, right? And the way to change those is not always that way. Because some of those rules that are there are really, really important defenses for when things start going south, right? And so sometimes they prevent us from going north. So I'm not saying that.
Yeah, no, I want to respond to that.
Okay.
Because my willingness to go through the trial and through this experience was out of my deep love and commitment to the ELCA. I love this church. I really do. I felt like the church needed to have a mirror to see what are the implications of the policy that we have. That if we're going to change policy, Lutherans need to see this is what happens. Because by and large, most GLBT clergy disappear. And this is Darren's story. I need to give a little piece about that because he is as much a part of this story in the ELCA. He chose to go to the UCC. He was on leave from call doing chaplaincy work. His leave from call date came up about the same time that the charges were filed. The standing committee of the UCC was not meeting for 5 more weeks. He requested from his bishop a grace period to transfer seamlessly from the ELCA into the UCC. That request was denied. So the records of the ELCA show Darren Eastler removed. In every other instance of transfer, it's listed, transfer to whatever. So in a sense, he's disappeared from the ELCA. And that is the main primary story that happens. Or people just give up and go. Or I Well, I had a community of people who said, we'll stand with you. My authority came from their love and their commitment to the gospel. So I was able to kind of stand and let the, and there were a lot of people at Churchwide Assembly who talked to me who had no idea that we even had this policy, much less that we have a system of dealing with things through trial in this kind of way. And it was all closed. The rules are it's closed door. No one could be in the room. There was, they wanted total blackout. They wanted us never to talk about it after it was done. And we said, Jesus came to bring light. And light is the solution to the dilemma of this church. So we felt like at each step we wanted to find, in a responsible, we tried to be fair. We agreed not to, you know, have press conferences during the trial or anything like that, that we would wait till it was all done. We would wait till the decision was made to give the process freedom to not have that pressure. We, you know, willing to do that. But we were going to tell the story because people need to hear that story. So that's kind of answering two of those questions. I feel like there is a reason to have a church body that can speak larger than just one congregation. I happen to like what Mark Hansen says about issues in Palestine. And a lot of the social issues that he speaks about, he says, this is what the ELCA says. And I appreciate that dimension of an institution. Yeah.
It seems to me kind of strangely appropriate that this should happen in Atlanta, of course, the home of Martin Luther King. Do you see your action as sort of being in the same sense of civil disobedience, where if there is a law that you perceive to be inappropriate or unjust, you violate it openly and then are ready to pay the price for it, in effect, in order to call attention to the, I mean, it...
Precisely. I think that's exactly what I'm talking about when I say, hold up the mirror. You know, it was the scenes of the hoses and the dogs that moved things forward in the United States. That it is that kind of strategy, which in the end, it's the strategy of Jesus to say, to willingly, to choose to enter into suffering for the sake of redemption. Now, I'm not comparing myself to Jesus. Certainly. There were no nails, you know, no crosses. Actually, there were no crosses, not even in the hearing room. I suffer very little, so I want to be careful about that. But yes, it's a civil rights strategy.
What was the venue for this thing? Where did you meet? In the church?
In a hotel ballroom. It was more in one of the meeting rooms. And they planned it. It was down this long, windy hallway. But what was so funny, at the same time, there was this dental convention. And so down the hall to the trial were all these teeth and dental instruments and all these things. And so each day I'd be like, going down the hall thinking, I'm just glad I'm not going to the dentist. Because those things look much worse than what was going to happen in
So what did your post-trial press conference look like?
We had a couple, because there was a series of, you know, when the disciplinary hearing committee did its first announcement. We did that really more by press release, and we had a PR firm that helped us, because we wanted to keep doing ministry. We didn't want to be absorbed into all this. It was really important to us to just keep doing the work of the church. So we had help in keeping that away. And so our press person would schedule interviews with people and generally do that kind of in one block. The big one, though, was the Committee of Appeals decision when we had trucks parked all around the church. And we had plans for Sunday worship about how people could go out so they wouldn't get caught by TV cameras. And, you know, we're like, hams, go out this door. People who don't want to be on TV, go out this door. And we trained people to talk to the media because what we saw it as evangelism. We thought, this is a chance for us to say, God's love is for everyone, and we mean it. And this is particularly important in the South, where the predominant religious voice is sort of the Southern Baptist, moralistic, fundamentalist. We felt like we were called, we were given a pulpit to speak good news. And so we really wanted to take advantage of that. So we had talking points about God's love, and in a sense, we were inviting, it was a way to invite everybody to church.
Well, so you went through this, and the church chose to keep you, and you said the church hasn't been
disciplined or expelled. Or...
So how is it actually affecting you? Is it that if you chose to leave, you couldn't take another call, or that you don't have
have no mobility.
Okay.
In the church, and in the eyes of the ELCA, I'm not a pastor. So I've been on sabbatical, so missed our Synod Assembly. But next year, we'll have to attend Synod Assembly as a visitor.
Could you be
like
a delegate from the congregation?
Well, I could, because technically in their eyes, I'm a lay person. But for me, I feel like it would be important to sort of say, we haven't accepted that decision, and I would rather stand at the edge and talk to everybody going by than be in the...
This is a really interesting point, because a number of the churches have responded by acting as if they were members in good standing of the ELCA, and you were planning to do that too.
Right. We were talking about raising our benevolence. If we got thrown out, we were going to raise our benevolence. We were going to go. And our congregation actually has a lot of people that are very involved in the Synod. We have members who are on the Synod staff. And so we were going to keep doing that. That we would, our strategy throughout was to, in a larger way, be more Christian than everybody, be more Lutheran than everybody, because it was a chance for us to witness about our relationships with the rest of the church. We were not interested in being apart from the church. It was never, the Synod actually came and asked us to leave the ELCA. That was they came and said, we have a creative idea. We could solve this whole problem. Here it is. You resign, the church leaves the ELCA, and we'll let you come to every meeting that you would be allowed to come to as a non-ELCA congregation. And we said, that's not what we want. That's not what we want. And we never felt like everybody had to agree with us. This does not have to be a church of one mind, but can we be a church that walks together? I think this journeying together faithfully in the midst of disagreement, that's a really profound Lutheran claim about what the church does.
Is there a new policy being submitted next spring, and does it include this idea?
I think things are just now sort of in process for what's going to happen in 2009. There will be, for those of you who are in synods and involved, there will be sample resolutions that come out probably this fall that can be brought to your synod assemblies. Because the way the church will change isn't by just coming up in Chicago. It's synods passing resolutions, sending them to Chicago. So it's really important for people in synods to speak, to be involved, and to be strategizing.
Also, if your synod hasn't yet elected its delegates to the Unified Assembly, it's really important for you to try to become a delegate.
Yeah.
I just thought it would be nice to clarify that these courts are for more than just for gay, lesbian issues. That, I mean, they do serve a very useful role in the church. I don't know if you want to speak to that just for a few, a minute or two.
That's right. There have actually, though, been very few situations that ever have gone to trials in the ELCA. Our polity tends to work in such a way that things don't reach that level. When there's a serious problem, congregations usually have already, you know, been engaging with the synod staff to remove a pastor who may be harming someone or a congregation. But you're right, and I'm not saying we shouldn't have.
Well, I just didn't want to get the impression that these courts are set up to deal with the
With justice, right. No, it's a,
What is your position now in your particular church? Can you administer the sacraments and that sort of thing?
Yes. I consider myself called and ordained.
Okay.
That I was in 1989 approved by the ELCA. I was called to a congregation and ordained. There's a congregation that has called me. So in my own thinking, the authority of call doesn't necessarily come from the larger institution, but from the assembly.
Okay. That's the confessional language. The Augsburg Confession places the power to call the pastor for the right administration of the sacraments and preaching of the gospel in the hands of the assembled believers in a particular place. So the ELCA doesn't actually have, according to our confessions, the ELCA doesn't have that power.
So in spite of what ELCA, you are acting as a full-fledged pastor.
Yeah. You know, and it's really only outside, away from St. John's that I become the big gay pastor who's been defrocked. You know, I have all my frocks at St. John's. You know, and our life on a regular day-to-day basis is really regular congregational ministry, and we're not thinking about this.
We just finished, like I said this morning, a year-long process of the Reconciling in Christ program, which was amazing and very spirit-filled. Do you have any recommendations now? We're at the where do we go from here? We've passed it, we've got the stickers, and it's on the bulletins.
Well, I think to figure out, how does your congregation, your place, live more deeply into that commitment? How do you extend the welcome? How do you let people know that you've made this decision to be a welcome place? And would you be willing to call a gay or a lesbian pastor, or a gay or lesbian pastor who's partnered.
And is extraordinary ministries the best way to go?
That's one of the extraordinary Lutheran ministries is a sort of roster that developed to approve candidates for ministry that the ELCA wouldn't. Everything's the same except for agreement about the policy. There are candidacy committees that, so people are approved. And so there's now a roster of ELM pastors and candidates to be called who have been approved. I'll actually join that roster myself. I just have to fill out the paperwork. And I, after the last couple of years, I just have not been interested in filling out paperwork.
Can you describe that organization, ELM? What is it?
Well, ELM, it's really an organization that has set as its mission developing ministries, supporting ministries that will call gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender clergy.
Does it have headquarters? Does it have staff?
They have one development staff, but it's
I think there's a board that runs.
There's a board, there are committees. It really started out of the PLTS experience and other gay seminarians, and people said, well, you know what, we should form a group and approve them. And this group has also then ordained people. When a congregation calls someone not approved, what happens is there's an extraordinary, which comes, Christopher Stendahl sort of coined the term. Extraordinary doesn't mean just extra special, you know, fabulous. It's extra ordinal.
Also from the Confessions.
Is it?
It's from the Treatise on the Power and Primacy of the Pope. When the bishops go against the gospel and are not willing to ordain priests to serve the church, then the congregation has the authority to ordain extra
ordinal.
Yeah, whatever the Latin term is. And Phil Melanchthon wrote that as an addendum to the Augsburg Confession, because this question came up, where are we going to get our clergy now that we've gotten into this big fight with Rome and the bishops aren't yet, we don't have bishops to supply ordained pastors. So that tradition from the Confessions is invoked in this situation for the sake of ordaining candidates who every other way are prepared.
And groups of pastors get together and ordain.
We need to stop, yeah. So let's thank Brad for sharing and engaging us, and then if people want to stay and talk a little bit more, you're welcome to do that, but it'll let those who want to head off to the next thing they're going to do that. So thank you very much.